From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Karen Joy Fowler, whose new historical novel is Booth, which concerns the family behind one of the most infamous figures in American history, John Wilkes Booth. The book came out last week from Putnam. Karen Joy Fowler is the New York Times bestselling author of six novels, including The Jane Austen Book Club and We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves, which was the winner of the Pen Faulkner Award and shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. She lives in Santa Cruz, California. Here's a little information about her novel, Booth. In 1822, a secret family moves into a secret cabin some 30 miles northeast of Baltimore to farm, to hide, and to bear 10 children over the course of the next 16 years. Junius Booth, breadwinner, celebrated Shakespearean actor, and master of the house in more ways than one, is at once a mesmerizing talent and a man of terrifying instability. One by one, the children arrive, as year by year the country draws frighteningly closer to the boiling point of secession and civil war. As the tenor of the world shifts, the Booths emerge from their hidden lives to cement their place as one of the country's leading theatrical families. But behind the curtains of the many stages they have graced, multiple scandals, family triumphs, and criminal disasters begin to take their toll, and the solemn siblings of John Wilkes Booth are left to reckon with the truth behind the destructively specious promise of an early prophecy. Booth is a startling portrait of a country in the throes of change and a vivid exploration of the ties that make and break a family. As I read this book, I was shocked to learn just how fascinating and celebrated the Booth family already was before Lincoln's assassination, and how their lives were impacted by this terrible event. When we spoke last week, I began by asking Karen Joy Fowler to talk about her decision to write about the family. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
It was kind of a circuitous route to this book. I started by writing a short story about the Lincoln assassination. It's actually a time travel story. And I had this idea that time travel would just be another form of tourism, and that there would be destination vacations, and that maybe one of those would be the Lincoln assassination. Ghastly as it is to think of that as your holiday. So I did a lot of research around the conspiracy and around John Wilkes Booth in order to write that story. And then as part of that research, I stumbled on to his older brother, the very famous actor, Edwin Booth. And I wrote another short story about Edwin. And I eventually wrote a third short story about their father and a funeral he held for passenger pigeons. And by that time, I was, you know, just the family had their hooks in me. They're such an incredible group of people. But the book came about really in response to, one of our periods of back-to-back mass shootings. And I was thinking about the issue of America and its guns and also about the families of the shooters. I'm not the first writer to have thought of this, but obviously the victims are, the families of the victims are going through something unbearable, but the families of the shooters are facing their own kind of horror. And because I was already pretty deeply immersed in the Booth family, because John Wilkes Booth is arguably the most famous man with a gun in all of American history, I started wondering if I went and looked, if I do the research, am I going to feel that the family is culpable in some way? Could they have seen it coming? Should they have stopped him? And also, what was the impact of the assassination on their own lives? Those are the questions I started with.
So it's interesting. You mentioned guns as one of the things that brought you to write this. I have so many notes, I'm not going to be able to find it, but interspersed between your narrative about the Booths are historical sections about Lincoln and quotes from Lincoln. And one of the quotes had something to do with the fact that you cannot just make slavery go away. I'm not quoting him, but the sentiment of the quote is you cannot make slavery just go away at the drop of a hat. It's going to be very, very difficult. And at the time I read the quote, I was thinking, well, that's what we're facing now with guns. And
yes.
I wanted to ask you a little bit. I was really astounded to read about the Booth family. I did not know anything outside of John Wilkes Booth, and not that much about him, to be honest. I knew he was an actor.
Well, that's where I started as well.
Is that true?
Yeah.
You didn't know?
No.
Wow. So, because they were an incredible family, and I know that some of what you've written is from your imagination, particularly, I guess, Rosalie, his sister, but just an incredible family. And I guess that there was quite a historical record about many of them.
Yes, my three point of view characters are the oldest girl, Rosalie, and then the next brother, who's much, much younger, because four children between between Rosalie and Edwin died in their childhoods. And then Asia, the youngest girl. So those are my three point of view characters. And for Edwin and Asia, there's an extensive record that they left. They wrote letters, and those letters are still available. And Asia wrote three books, only one of which is quite personal, but she wrote one about her father, one about her brother, Edwin, that they're very focused on their acting careers, and there's not so much intimate family detail. But the third one that she wrote about John Wilkes Booth, which was only published many decades after her death, is very intimate. And you can see how much she loved him and how close the two of them were. And there's a lot of information about what their lives were like during the period that they were on the farm together. So
are all of those books still in print, or are they available?
They are. No, they absolutely.
Yeah, that's interesting. And she was an interesting character as well. I loved her spirit, although I felt for Rosalie, but I only felt for the Rosalie that you created.
Yes. Fair enough. Asia is, you know, she's a force. And I sort of liked her and disliked her in equal measure. She certainly held her hatreds close to the chest, and they burned pretty bright. She did have an unforgiving nature, but I think that she was, my guess is that she was the smartest of the Booths. She was certainly the best educated in the family. And I think she, you know, just everything else aside, she's quite a good writer.
So you do an interesting thing in one of Asia's point of view chapters, and it's right after her father dies. Maybe I just picked up on it because I was getting to know her for the first time. Maybe you do this in other areas as well. But do you mind if I read a few excerpts from one of the chapters?
No, I'd love it.
Okay. This is, as I say, this is right after her father dies. Let's see. Okay. So I'm going to read actually quite a bit, and then I'll ask you about it. So also, I'm excerpting. This is not exactly how it runs in the book. At 17, Asia has a strong and stormy nature. Then there's a sentence later. Asia wants everything in her life to be beautiful. The objects in her home, her clothing, her thoughts. And then she gets Rosalie to help her recover the parlor wallpaper with white drapes in anticipation of the arrival of Father's body. She removes every object from the room, except for a statue of Shakespeare. Later you write, Mother lifts her veil, her round face sagging with exhaustion. Asia has come outside without her shawl. She shivers and her breath clouds the air. And then later, a glass lid set in the coffin over Father's face. Asia at one point yanks her crinoline off so desperately that it tears. And then this is the sentence that made me start looking back and writing all these down. The doctor comes, and at one point you write, "The lenses of his glasses are so filthy. She wonders that he can see." He pours something brown and bitter into a small metal cup. Later, she falls asleep, and when she awakens, sweat or maybe drool has stuck her hair to her cheek. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. It goes on. It's just incredible, beautiful detail, and I think you do this so well. And I'm sure you do it throughout the book, but I felt like you did this more for Asia's narrative than anyone else's. I felt like there was more detail there. And I wondered if that was on purpose and if it was maybe because she was a writer.
I don't think I did that on purpose. And I expect it's because her books were so helpful to me that I had so much to go on when I wrote her chapters, so
these details maybe really were true.
Well, you know, it was true that that when both Asia and John looked through the glass, the little glass window over the coffin, that they did not believe their father was dead, and that both of them sort of collapsed in a hysterical fit, shouting that their father was still alive. That is true. You know, the fact that she drooled when she slept. No, I made that part
that
up.
That was great. And I mean, honestly, the lenses of the doctor's glasses, that just made me stop. I was like, this is so great.
Thank you.
Because a lot of this, you know, it never is dry, but it could be dry history. You know, if somebody does too much research and just recounts the research in a factual manner. And so what I really loved and truly appreciated was the way you fill it out with these beautiful details. It really jumped out at me in that scene.
Well, it's an issue for any book, isn't it? You know, when you're going to summarize, when you're going to work in narration, and when you're going to move into scene is just an issue on every page that you write.
Now, I was interested that you sometimes used humor in the book and that the narrative became kind of funny sometimes. One example is, let's see. Sometimes father's reviews describe him as inebriated, a word Henry mispronounced without correction. Anne Hall told him that inebriated meant full of spirit, and for a long time the children all believed inebriated was the very highest praise, until grandfather, in an unkind moment, told them otherwise. But that was kind of funny. It was a little funny. There's this gentle narrative. You can sense the energy of the household and the kind of crazy chaos when their father is around. But the humor too, which I loved, was that hard to work on?
No, I think, and I was maybe even more conscious of this fact in my previous book, We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves, that I know that I'm going to be asking the reader to go through some hard times, that, you know, there are going to be some very unhappy things occurring in the book. And I myself, as a reader, in a nonfiction book, I am willing to go as unhappy as you wish me to, because what is real, and there's no point in pretending otherwise. But in a fiction book, there's a limit to how much, as a reader, I am willing to suffer. The humor is supposed to ease the reader, give the reader a few moments to hopefully to find something funny. Life is that mix of even some of the most horrific things can be quite funny. I for years thought, I don't want to die in a hilarious way, you know, but I completely changed my mind about that. I thought, you know, why should I deprive people of the innocent fun of finding my death hilarious?
I want to talk a little bit about the interweaving. Let's see if I can find this question. The interweaving of interesting historical facts. So, and I think this is something that must be kind of fun to do when you're writing historical fiction. So, for example, there's there's a couple that comes to the house after John Wilkes Booth assassinates the president. And that couple, well, it sounds like perhaps the husband was a fairly good man, but the wife apparently had a reputation for not being very nice. And you say that Rosalie doesn't like her. But then you also quote Mark Twain as saying that he doesn't like her. And he's very, it's very funny. I'm not finding my question, so I can't tell you the quote.
Yeah, he's got a name for her that I'm not bringing to mind now, either Dunderskype or something like that.
Right. And then,
he said, Lord, I hate that woman.
Right. And I thought, okay, that's really interesting that you can do that in this novel, because
he's not a part of this scene, but we know in this year now, both of these stories, we know who he is. And so you're able to kind of interweave that together in a way that expands it for us and makes it interesting. And it's perfect because, of course, this woman is not very nice. You later comment that she's gotten herself all gussied up to go over and tell these poor people that John Wilkes Booth, their son, their brother, has killed the president. So what a terrible person. What a terrible woman.
That's the beauty of the omniscient voice, is the ability to step outside and, another thing that I found interesting that I am guessing readers will also find interesting is that Louisa May Alcott went to see Edwin Booth perform, and having already seen his father, thought that he was a better actor than his father was. So.
Yeah, I was happy. I was happy for Edwin that he had such success ultimately, because his father, I don't know. I know his father was a character, but he wasn't always very nice.
I know. It's a paradox, isn't it, that in books and movies and television, we can be so charmed and entertained by characters that if they were actually in our lives would be a misery to actually spend time with these people, and yet we happily watch them in somebody else's story.
But I also thought you did a really good job after the father's his name is Junius, and that's June, his other son was named for, right? Well, when Junius dies, you do this beautiful job of showing Edwin as grief-stricken and guilty. Feels guilty because he felt that he should have been with his father at the time. But also, you know, it's just really real. His opinion of his father kind of comes and goes and changes. And he rewrites history in his own family for himself. And they all miss their father terribly, even though he was so difficult. It's true, you know, with difficult people, you might miss them later. I'm generalizing, but, you know, sometimes the people that are hard, we really miss them.
I think, and I will admit, I am speaking from personal experience. I had a very difficult father and I had a very easy mother. And in many ways, my father's death was the more difficult, partly because I was much younger. He died when I was in college. And so I never had a chance to kind of put our relationship right. And so, you know, it haunts me in a way that my mother's death does not, because there's nothing to regret in my relationship with my mother. You know, we were very close. I knew that she knew how much I loved her, that obviously I missed her. I will always miss her, but there's not that sense that I should have done something different, that now it's too late to make things right, that keeps my father's death kind of haunting me.
Well, that probably informed your narrative as you wrote about Edwin.
Probably so, yeah.
So I did mention before the interweaving of history, and I just want to mention two more things that were interesting to me. One is that John Wilkes Booth was in the crowd to see John Brown executed.
Not only in the crowd, but made his way into the cell, had a private conversation with John Brown, about which, sadly, I could find nothing, but I know that it happened.
Right. And then that other thing that was so interesting to me is that Edwin saved Robert Lincoln.
I know, it's bizarre, isn't it?
I mean, did he save him from... He didn't save him from death, we don't know, but he definitely pulled him out of a situation where he could have been crushed by a moving train only weeks before his father was assassinated.
As I understand it, The trains were moving very slowly. It is true that that Robert Lincoln could have been badly hurt, but I don't think that Edwin saw it as as a crisis. I think it was kind of a non-event in his life, but it was not a non-event in Robert Lincoln's life. And he went back and he told General Grant about it, and the news got to Edwin, who had not understood that it was the president's son that he had pulled up to the train platform. But I think, after the assassination, it became a very important story to
right.
him, that he had had this interaction with Robert Lincoln, that he, he was very, very pro-Lincoln himself, very much a supporter of Lincoln. And so I think when the country thought of the Booth family as this nest of snakes, that it was comforting to him to remember that this thing had happened.
Right. Now, sorry, I've got two questions in my brain and they're circling and I forget the one I was going to ask you first. So he's terribly unpopular after this happens. The whole family gets death threats and is threatened with imprisonment, and they are imprisoned, a few people, while they're being investigated. But 9 months later, Edwin goes back on stage and the public reaction really surprised me. That was really interesting. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think when the assassination first happens, Edwin announces that he's retiring. He just thinks it would be unseemly for any Booth to ever go on stage again. But he is financially responsible for pretty much everyone in this large and sprawling family. And I don't know to what extent that was the factor that made him change his mind, or if he missed the stage, but as you said, he made it 9 months without performing, and then he went back on the stage. And during that time, again, as you said, they had been getting death threats, and he in particular had been told that if he went on the stage, he would be shot the way that Lincoln was shot. And I think that he lived in a kind of bubble of support among his close friends, but he was aware of a great hostility out in the larger world. And I think it was an act of some courage to go on the stage. But he was known for being pro-Lincoln, and he was a beloved actor prior to the assassination. And I think the people who went to the theater to see him understood the kind of suffering that he was going through, as well as the suffering that the country was going through. And so before he made a speech, they were on their feet. And this is, there's an article in the New York Times about how many ovations he got before he even began to speak, and how moved he was, how much sobbing there was.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the structure of the book. You do, as you say, highlight three narrative points of view, although from a sort of distant perspective that's removed a little bit. It's not the first person. And then you also interweave these historical details. You have interludes about Lincoln, and then there are quotes from Lincoln. You change tense sometimes, past and present, in those different areas. You have a lot of different settings. There was a lot to keep track of, the history of the theater, the history of the country, the Civil War, the history of slavery. Plus, you've got this incredible story arc that's tooting right along. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the structure and how you organized yourself.
I think one of the things that I have discovered, and this is now my seventh novel, is that I work best if I can think of a novel as broken into constituent parts. I have written, as I said, this is my seventh novel. Three of the previous novels, I did not do that for. Three of them I think of as sort of a continuous narrative movement.
Right.
And those three were by far the hardest to write. And for whatever reason, and I'm not claiming this is the secret sauce, but they are also not as successful as the
as
the ones that I was able to think that, you know, I don't have a plot. I don't know where it's all I did in the booth, know where it was going to end. But in general, I don't.
Yeah.
Right. But I have just kind of a structure. So for the Jane Austen Book Club, as a clear example, I knew that the book would take 6 months, that the book club would meet six times, that there would be six people in the book club. So we would get into everybody's house and we would look at the six major novels of Jane Austen. And again, when I started, I didn't know anything about the people or what their stories would be, but I had this structure. And so in a similar way, for Booth, I knew that I needed the oldest sister to start because it would be the only one old enough to remember that. So there were 10 children in the family, but four of them died, and she would be the only one old enough to remember the deaths of the four children, and those deaths seemed to me to have shaped the family in a very, very significant way, even though the younger children have no memory of these brothers and sisters that they lost. So I knew I would start with her, and then I knew that that I would move to Edwin, because when they moved to Baltimore, Rosalie is too much of a hermit to be the best person to talk about the things that happened to them when they moved into the city, because mm-hmm. they had lived on the farm. And then Asia, you know, just because she left such a beautiful record, it was she was the easiest to deal with because I had so much of her help in telling her story. So
right.
Mainly I knew that I would alternate between those three characters. And then it was largely a matter of who would have the most interesting experience in the time period that I was then focused on. I will say that I have never before written a book that covered years, decades, okay. and that was its own kind of challenge because I had never done that. So
were you pretty knowledgeable about this period of time apart from the Booths?
Well, I have written other novels that take place in America during the Victorian period, but they are all on the West Coast. So it was, you know, I knew certain things about it. One of the coincidental helpful things is that the Booth family was kind of on the periphery of so many of the great moments in that time period, so that Edwin Booth went to California and performed in the mining camps and had his own experience with sort of the gold rush. And then, as you said, John was at John Brown's hanging, and they were all in New York during the New York draft riots. And so, you know, some of the really touchstone events of the period are ones that they experienced very close at hand. And it allowed me to talk about these moments in a kind of personal way, as I imagine the Booths might have experienced them. And they certainly had a very intimate relationship with slavery as well, although they were not a slave-owning family and were in fact quite opposed, most of them, with the exception of John Wilkes, to slavery. It's still, you know, given what I can find in terms of what their experiences were and how closely involved they were in the lives of some of the enslaved people in Baltimore, it was frustrating to find so little that, with the exception of John, that any of them said or wrote on the subject. So I know that they were anti-slavery, but they not not vocally so, it appeared.
Yeah, so they were pretty entitled, weren't they?
They were very entitled, yes. And they had also, I think, been told by their father that actors couldn't afford to be political, that you didn't want to, you know, alienate half of the audience by holding political views. Again, you know, John was the exception. John was very vocal, very pro-slavery, very vocal about it, you know. No mistaking his politics.
And I haven't asked you specific questions too much about John because I'm trying to respect your opening statement that you really aren't going to give him a lot more notoriety. We only have a couple minutes left. So I'll just ask you one last question. I usually ask if my guest has any advice for writers at the end of the show because the show is for writers. So do you have any quick advice?
Yeah, absolutely. I might say that, you know, looking now back on a fairly long career, one of the things that I did not expect or understand was how much of the job is just kind of an emotional maintenance, that you face a lot of rejection, you face a lot of criticism, you face a lot of days when you're not inspired, and it's just, I feel that anybody who starts as a writer does it because they love the writing, they love trying to craft a story, and that there are all sorts of things that can take that joy, that pleasure away from you, and that that's something to pay attention to, that if you're not enjoying it, try to figure out why, try to get back to that place where you were when you started, when it was all fun.
Okay, that's wonderful advice. Thank you. I want to mention again that the name of the book we've been discussing is Booth, written by my guest, Karen Joy Fowler, and it's published by Putnam. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was a new interview. That was an interview with the author Karen Joy Fowler. It was a shorter interview that we were allotted, and we did run out of time, but I asked what she has read lately, and she replied that she has recently read and loved Meg Waite Clayton's The Postmistress of Paris. She says it's a beautiful book and highly, highly recommended. And also Colm Tóibín's magnificent new novel, The Magician. Those are her words and her recommendations. You can learn more about Karen at karenjoyfowler.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Karen Joy Fowler, who suggests picking one of the great emotions, fury, joy, envy, terror. Write a scene from your childhood in which you experienced that emotion, maybe, but not necessarily for the first time. If you are in the midst of a fictional project, write the scene for one of your characters instead. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the week. The Norshire Bookstore in Manchester Center and Saratoga Springs presents a free New York Public Library Princeton University Press event, Celebrate the Ides of March, with Mary Beard and Tim Gunn. Beard speaks about her latest book, 12 Caesars. That's taking place Tuesday, March 15th at 6:30. And then they will have a virtual event on March 16th at 4. Norshire presents book picks for educators, calling teachers and librarians. They're going to partner with the Iroquois Reading Council to offer this event. Also that same day at 6 p.m., Peter Swanson presents Nine Lives with Liv Constantine. Nine Lives is his latest thriller. So you can learn more about the Norshire events at northshire.com. Bear Pond Books in Montpelier still has its winter reading bingo going on. More information about that, which goes until March 21st, is available on the Bear Pond website, bearpondbooks.com. The Fletcher Free Library presents their Food for Talk Cookbook Club Sunday, March 13th at 3. The cookbook is Parwana, Recipes and Stories from an Afghan Kitchen by Durkani Ayubi. The South Burlington Library in South Burlington, Vermont presents a hybrid open mic Wednesday, March 16th at 6, where people are invited to share something that they have written or just love, or just come and listen. More information, you can email sbplprograms@southburlingtonvt.gov, and that will be a virtual event, and they'll send a Zoom link. Phoenix Books presents a celebration of forgotten women in history with Marie Benedict, Kate Moore, Heather Webb, and Catherine Gregorio. This is a virtual offer event presented with Source Books. It'll be at 7 p.m. As I said, it's a virtual event. More information at phoenixbooks.biz. And then on the 21st of March, Phoenix Books presents Martin, Melissa, and Mouse, Protecting Our Freedom to Read, a conversation with Essex School Board candidates Laura Taylor and Marlon Verasimi, 7 p.m. Again, that's another virtual event. More information at phoenixbooks.biz. And finally, another virtual event at the Phoenix, Amy Klinger, in light of recent events, will have a virtual book launch March 22nd. It's an author Q&A hosted by Benjamin Roche at 7 p.m. on March 22nd. More information at phoenixbooks.biz. I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com, where you can get all the archived episodes going back to 2008. New and recent episodes of Write the Book are available wherever you get your podcasts. Just subscribe there and you'll have them sent to your podcast app. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week, so be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. You can also access the podcast and link to our social media presence at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it and talk about it, tell your friends. Up next at 5 o'clock, please stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.